Thank you very much indeed, Barry, and a wonderful good afternoon to you all. I've got to say how nice it is to be back. It's been a long time, and Marsha and I have missed services, but we have watched services every Sabbath in Denver, and we do appreciate the cybercast there. I made a comment to Elmer Wilkie the other day when I said to him, you know, Elmer, you're very famous on the internet. He said, I am. He said, well, he said, I didn't know that kind of thing. I said, yes, I see the back of your head every Sabbath because it's on this side here and Scott Ashley's on the other side and the speaker's right in the middle. I notice they've changed it now. So Elmer and Scott have disappeared and we're back to just the speaker. But it's great to see services and have that facility, you know. It's been a long time, and Marsha's operation on her knee went very well. It's a very complex operation and very invasive. It involves the nerves, the muscles, the sinews, the ligaments and everything else that's in there, and then all of the inflammation. For the first 2 weeks she was on quite heavy medication just to sustain the pain, and then the third week she dropped down to a lower level and she wanted to get off, and now she's completely off them. But it takes a very long time to recover, as Marilyn would know. Marilyn's famous comment on the card which you all signed was, no whining. She's not whining. She's very committed and a driven person physically. Marsha is. That's one of the reasons why she was in physical education. And she's out there challenging herself. We've actually taken one walk right around our circle with the pusher, which we have got, thanks to Scott and Anthony, who lent us, whatever you call it, a walker. They've lent us a walker. So that was a major milestone. And we do exercises three times a day, plus her walking around and moving and all the rest of it. She really is dedicated to getting this thing put in place, but it takes up to a year to completely get over and all the swelling to go down, which is quite a considerable time. Anyway, I have a note from her to you. She says, thank you for the lovely card that was sent to me with all your kind thoughts and words of encouragement. It did its job. I missed seeing all of you every week, and thank you for being such good friends to Arthur and me. I will return as soon as I can. Don't anyone sit in my seat. Don't forget that. She might get jealous. With love, Marsha. Okay, so thank you for those who have been kind enough to pray for us, which I'm assuming everyone did. I'm very grateful because she's had this bad knee since she was a teenager, which is a very long time. And we went downstairs with Jerry and Steve, and my automatic thing to do was to walk in front because Marsha always puts her hand on my shoulders to come down behind me because of the gammy left knee. Well, pretty soon I'm going to be putting my hand on her shoulder and she can lead me downstairs. So that will be a wonderful thing to happen. I do want to mention Gail Wolstenholm. She's basically, what is happening is her spinal column is collapsing due to osteoporosis. She's in a great deal of pain, and she went into the hospital and had, I want to say a magnetic resonance imaging, but it's the other one, a CT, because they were frightened. She had the operation on her an embolism in her brain, and she'd had that. And the last time she went in, the machine, the scan sounded off that there was something there and that they couldn't do it, so they did this. And, you know, scheduling just takes time. So I don't know what the results are, but I talked to her via email yesterday and today, and I'm going back on my way home to anoint her, because although they said her head was normal, there's still a problem for the magnetic resonance and imaging to see what they might be able to do about that. So it's a very, very difficult situation when your body is in that sort of condition. And she's lost about 6 inches of height with the osteoporosis and her head and back and upper shoulders, they're just sagging forward like that. So we trust God will be merciful. So please remember her in your prayers. Okay. I'm always fascinated when someone gets up and gives a sermonette and it just dovetails. I'm amazed. It happens so many times, so I certainly like to think that God is involved in what we talk about and how we talk about things. And John 50, what's it, 20, what, 21? John 21 is a very, very interesting place where the word love comes up. So guess what I'm talking about today? Love. June 6, 1944 was D-Day. I can't say I remember it well, but I was about 3 years old. And I was aware of the war. And as a result of that, I did not realize as a child, obviously, the price that people would pay when young people, 18 or 19 or 20 years old, went to the Normandy beaches and gave their lives against incredible evil. About 5-6 years ago, my family and I, that's Bruce and Michelle and the girls, went to France for the feast, and we took a trip to Normandy. And as we came through into the area and walked among those white gravestones, Marcia burst into tears. It is a wonderful experience, but it's also a horrible experience to realize how many hundreds of people are lying in that ground who, when they left those little boats and went ashore, were mowed down by machine guns. They laid down their lives to stop unbelievable evil. In 1957, I joined the Royal Navy. And after I'd been through boot camp, I went to a place called HMS Dryad, D-R-A-Y-A-D. HMS Dryad was a radar training school. And the radar systems at the time were fairly basic or fundamental. They were only developed basically at the beginning of World War II. And HMS Dryad was in an old house called Portsdown House. And it was on Portsdown Hill. And in that rather large old house was a big room like this. And if you can imagine that the wall behind me was glassed in. Behind that wall was a clock, was a map of Omaha Beach and June of the D-Day invasions. And the clock was stopped at the time of the invasion beginning. And I'd go in there and look at that. I didn't really appreciate it at the time because I was only 16, 17 years old. But I'd go and look at that, and it was a constant reminder each time I went in there to see these tapes going from ships, going to the different beaches in different colours, and that is where they planned the D-Day invasions. The sacrifice that these men paid, the ultimate price, out of love for country and love for freedom. Did they really understand what they were doing? Personally, as a young man, I really didn't understand my feelings of patriotism, which I had, principally because my father had hatred for the Germans and hatred for the Japanese and made it very, very clear that they were terrible people, and that is why he went to war in the jungles of Burma. But I was willing to go to war because, in that sense, it was the right thing to do. Protect my country, And if it brought me to the place where I'd have to be willing to lay down my life, although I really didn't think that through as a young man, being in the Royal Navy, I was prepared to do that. Obviously, you have to do as you're told. The military is all about blind obedience. First thing you do in the military is you get a number, PJ977439. PJ stands for Portsmouth, J stands for Junior, 16, and 977439 was the number that I was assigned to. Never forget that. I remember my father coming back from World War II, and he had his number memorized too, 8808, whatever it was, I've forgotten now. But he had his number memorized. So you have a number, then you have a uniform, then you have your head shaved, then you're taught how to make your bed, how to do your laundry, how to say yes sir, no sir, three bags full sir, how high shall I jump sir, how to march in line and in step with everybody else. Because you have to have the mindset of doing what you're told without questioning it. I was not taught love. I was taught hate. And as I get older, I suppose, as I look back and I see what the world is like today, I think the world's going crazy. Why? Because there's so much change taking place in our society as it evolves. The way of social media has developed is isolating people from one another rather than having them together. And I see young people when they're in my company, they're sitting down and they're going, whatever they're doing with their thumbs, I don't know, but it's not involved and engaged in a conversation all too many times. I see people on the phone not paying attention, and it's more important that they talk than to seriously consider you're driving a lethal weapon of 1,000 pounds or so, whatever it is, and you really ought to be paying attention with two hands and focusing on the job. We're into our own world, and we learn to speak and use words in a certain way because that's the way we understand them in the context of our lives. Then we have children and grandchildren, and as I watch how society is changing and how technology is exploding and changing our world incredibly. For me, add to the fact that I changed countries. I became an American citizen and had to learn a new language. You say, but we all speak English. No, you don't. You just think you do. You speak American English, and I tend to speak English English or British English. To illustrate the point, we use different words in America than they use in England, right? About 6 months ago, I heard some tragic news. A guy called Graham Mitchell fell down the stairs in his home. He fainted and fell down, broke his neck, and quadriplegic. That was 6 months ago. He still is in hospital in ICU. Okay? And when I heard that, I called up his wife, Maggie. Now, Maggie and Graham, I ordained Graham a local elder in the Northampton Church. Very intelligent people. I'm not sure if Maggie's got her PhD, but Graham has. And both were teaching at university. And so I called up Maggie and said how sorry I was. It's been a long time, 30-some years, 35 years since we've actually spoken. And I said, you know, I want to give you a call once in a while because you were of such great help to me when Joyce got cancer and died and supported me. I want to support you now. So I talked to Maggie about once a month. And it's amazing how American I am. How American I am. Maggie sounds strange to me. And I say things like, we'll touch bases with you later. And it's in the ballpark. And so forth. And I say, oh, I'm sorry. Because it comes out automatically. But these are American idioms and terminology that I use without a second thought. And I say process instead of process. And so on and so on. Over the past several years, I have really enjoyed retirement and taking the time to study and to read and to luxuriate in biblical language. And when I said to Maggie, I shudder at some of the thoughts as I think back to the sermons I gave back then when I was in Northampton, compared to the way I feel and think and have had the opportunity of education and time and so forth now. And she said, well, why? And then she made the most wonderful compliment I think anyone could give, even though my sermons were probably stupid and lousy. She said, we were safe with you. That made me feel really good. And I was most grateful for her confidence. And I must say that I've had enormous opportunity to learn a lot differently and be a little bit more disciplined. So language, love, process, etc., etc., plays a great deal in what we understand and believe as Christians. Plays a great place. For example, the Jews base their understanding in the Hebrew language, basically. The Catholics use Latin and Greek throughout their history, combined with logic and reason, and you can get anywhere with that formality. The Protestants have focused on the Greek language mainly because the New Testament was written in Greek, but they've relieved themselves from Catholic dogma, and now anything goes, and you can find anything you want, anywhere you want, and you're free to do what you want, and nobody really cares. And the Church of God, there's a messianic movement which emerged in the 60s, which combined certain Jewish rabbinic practices with Christian mentality, and they're kind of in a mess themselves, in all too many cases. And the Church of God holds the unusual position among Christianity. One thing that we all agree on, though, is that God loves humanity. We all agree on that, don't we? So I want to show you two words. I want to explain two words that define godly love for us. This is Sean said in his sermonette, you know, about learning to be the product, because you don't know who you're affecting around you. And so the reason for this is that God could not show any greater love to us than to give his son, that he would sacrifice his life for humanity. And then as time came around, 50 days after the sacrifice, basically, the Holy Spirit was given that we may understand the scriptures. I emphasize that and pause. The scriptures. Luke 24:44. Jesus opened the mind of the disciples to the scriptures. The two men on the road to Emmaus, he opened their mind that they might understand the scriptures. So we'll be celebrating Shavuot or Pentecost tomorrow. And our society looks on the word love as emotion. And certainly there is emotion in the concept of love. But we very often use the word loosely. When a young man says to a young lady, I love you, what does he mean? You better find out. Be sure you know what his intentions are, if you will. So watch out for those emotions. And whereas God, when God uses the term love, it is quite different. Now, in Hebrew, there are two words that are used to describe love. I have a bias. Okay? When you go from one language to another, always meaning is lost, number one. Number two, the words that we use in one language, in Hebrew, do not mean exactly the same as the words used in Greek or in English, right? They're not the same. So we have two Hebrew words. The first word is ahab, A-H-A-B. And the second word is hesed, H-E-S-E-D. And Dr. Hay once said, you can't understand the New Testament until you first understand the Old Testament. And I've been working on understanding the Old Testament. And when it comes to understanding godly love, we are talking about both actually something we do and something we have the right emotion, motivation, feeling about doing. You can't have one without the other. So let's take the first word, ahab. It is a verb. Anyone want to tell me what a verb is? What is a verb? You know? An action. It's an action, isn't it? It's what we do. I love you. I love is the verb in the verbal form. If you want the Strong's number, it's 157, and it's used 217 times, and it means to love and to like. Okay, that's the meaning of ahab. I love my wife in the verb form. My love for my wife is unending in the noun. So you see, there's two completely different meanings there, depending on whether it's a verb or a noun. So in Hebrew, we have ahab used in several ways. Husband-wife relationship it's used for. A special relationship between parents and children. A deep love of friends for each other, like Jonathan and David, if you will. They had a unique connection. I had a phone call from my buddy today, who's down in Matamoros in Mexico, and we talk each Sabbath, sometimes up to 2 hours. But he called me up, and we have a connection that I have with very, very few other people. That doesn't mean to say I don't like other people. I love all of you here. But he and I have an intimate relationship. He married my secretary and stole her from me, and I've never let him forget it. And we've been connected. Now, that was 25 years ago, and we've formed a relationship which is unique and unusual. The fourth way of looking at love is for non-personal objects. I love my home. I love the land I live in. I love America. I love the country. I love the countryside. I love knowledge. I love exercise. And I love food. This is non-personal. And then finally, and fifth, the most important use of ahab is in the religious sphere in Hebrew. Ahab is used 19 times of humans loving God, which is including loving his name, his law, and precepts and commandments. We have to have a connection with that. So chief among these uses, of course, is found in a very important place called the Shema. Now, we all know where that is, don't we? We all know where the Shema is. I hope we do. No? No? Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy chapter 6. This is one of the two great commandments, Deuteronomy 6. This is like the statement of faith or confession of faith that is used in the synagogue every Sabbath, if you will. The Shema. It means to hear. I want to read the first several verses, in fact, verse 1 through 9. Now, this is the commandment, so that's the statement from God to us. And these are the statutes and judgments which the Lord or Yahweh or Elohim or the Lord your God commanded to teach you, that you may know and observe them in the land which you are going over to possess. They were going to go into the promised land, and these commandments and these statutes were going to be the fabric that was going to hold this nation together, like the Constitution, if you will. That you may fear the Lord your God to keep all his statutes. The word keep means guard and protect. His commandments, which I command you and your son and your grandchildren all the days of your life, that your days may be prolonged. Living God's way protects, as parents, our children. Living God's way for me meant I stopped doing the things wrong that I was doing. I was reading the wrong material. I was drinking too much alcohol when I had the opportunity, which wasn't very often. I spent 4 out of 6 years at sea, so that kept me safe most of the time. And I was smoking 30 or 40 cigarettes a day. Not a very good thing to do. But it's very addictive, nicotine. Thank God I stopped. I got on a good diet. I started exercising. I started cleaning up my mind. I started changing my life, because I wanted to obey God. And so here I am, coming up to 75. I can still function fully, all my joints are working. I don't know why, but I've never broken a bone in my body. And believe me, I've done judo, I've done boxing, I've done gymnastics, I've climbed masts 142 feet with bare feet and bare hands. And, I was a frogman in the Navy. If I should have been killed, I could have been killed. Never broken a bone. I'm amazed. I'm thankful for my genetic inheritance, but most of all, I'm thankful that I have been given God's way of life. Thankful for it. Because I'm quite sure, knowing my stupidity, I wouldn't be here today if I'd have continued down the road I was going. So, as a result of that, I have children. And I have grandchildren. Now, batting 500, American term for baseball, that means 50%. I don't know why they call it 500, but they do. One in and one out of the church. And so we ask ourselves a question, how long is that heritage going to carry on? Well, certainly it's been prolonged for three generations already. In fact, if I consider my mother, four. Therefore, Shema, hear, O Israel, and be careful to observe it that it may be well with you. And implicit in the word Shema, or hear, is do. Hear and do. It's not just hear. It's no good if you just hear and then turn around and walk away. Hear and do, O Israel, and be careful to observe it, that it may be well with you, that you may multiply greatly as the Lord your God of your fathers promised you, a land flowing with milk and honey. And that's an idiom for wealth and material and richness and fertility and so forth. Shema, hear, O Israel. The Lord your God, the Lord is Echad, is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. And there's that love word, Ahab. Love him. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. Action, obedience, and emotion. Conversion was possible in the Old Testament. Very clearly so. Love God with all your mind and obedience and your heart. Otherwise, how do we explain how Abel and Abraham and others in Hebrews 11 are in the first resurrection? They were converted. And you shall teach them, verse 7, diligently to your children and by example, in our workplaces and everything we do. And you shall talk to them as you sit in your house and when you walk by the way, when you lie down and when you get up. In other words, this is in your entire way of life. You shall bind them as a sign between your hands, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. And this is a metaphor of saying in every way, shape and form, inside your house and outside your house, as you walk about in everything you do, you are hearing God and living his ways. It is clear. So the Shema is a very important part of understanding godly love. God first makes some demands on us, doesn't he? When he calls us, he makes demands on us. He says, I want you to be obedient. He has conditions. He has stipulations. The Shema makes that clear. Statutes, commandments, statutes, judgments. They're conditions. They're conditions that God has. And he states what these conditions are. A loving God makes those statements because he is love. These are his principles. This is his way of saying to us, this is the way of life I want you to live, because that's the way of our life, if you will. This is who and what I am, and he knows it's best for us. And so very much like our worldly parents, which my parents didn't particularly do because they didn't know, But if they're good parents, they make demands on their children, and God also does the same thing to us. He's going to teach us how to live. And the motivation of fear is in that. Verse 2, that you may fear God. Oh, but God is a God of love. You don't have to fear him. Oh, yes, you do. You have to fear the fact that, number one, you're disobeying him if you are. Number two, that can have eternal consequences ultimately. We need to understand that. God's love is not sloppy. It's quite clearly defined. Obey so that your life, your children's lives, your grandchildren's lives may be prolonged, and to love him with all your heart, soul, and your might. Deuteronomy was written 38 years after the Exodus. They disobeyed after they got out of slavery. Now, logically, you'd think you're taken out of slavery, and the first thing you do is say, thank you. The miracles that they've witnessed, thank you. Yeah, I'll do as I'm told. Yes, sir, no, sir. Three banks, four, three. How high do you want me to jump, sir? Okay, I'll do it. Yes. But no. It didn't take very long before they were grumbling and moaning, complaining, and all of that generation died in the wilderness. 38 years later, we come back. They couldn't obey the simple things that God had told them to do, and he didn't tell them to love him back then. He told them to obey him. Now we come forward to 38 years later and coming into the promised land. And Moses now delivers the most important concept prior to going into the promised land. Of course, God had given it to him and he told him to write it down and so forth. But the question is, why should Israel love God? Why should we love God? First, he is the only creator God. He made us. He created heaven and earth. So he is the creator, and God there is, and all our religious interests should be directed towards him. Okay? All of our religious interests should be directed to him. Secondly, he has liberated them, and he has liberated us from slavery. This world is in slavery. This world, for the most part, is deceived. They don't know and understand. Let's have a look at Deuteronomy chapter 11. Deuteronomy, you know, you can get salvation out of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 11, verse 1. Therefore, you shall love the Lord your God. Again, the word is ahav. You shall love the Lord your God with and keep his charge, his statutes, his judgments, and his commandments always. They're not to stop. Know today that I do not speak with your children who have not known and who have not seen the chastening of the Lord your God, his greatness and his mighty hand and his outstretched arms. Remember, they were young. And many of them, the people that had seen him, died in the wilderness. His signs and his acts which he did in the midst of Egypt to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to all his land. What he did to the army of Egypt, to their horses, to their chariots. How he made it waters of the Red Sea overflow them as they pursued you. And how the Lord has destroyed them to this day. What he did for you in the wilderness until you came to this place, and what he did to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, the son of Reuben, how the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, and their households, their tents, and all their substance that was in their possessions in the midst of all Israel. But your eyes have seen every great act of the Lord which he did. They saw it. They had plenty of evidence. And I wonder if they feared. They should. I think one of the great things today is we see in society, in so many sections of it, they have no sense of fear. They have no sense of consequence. Therefore, verse 8, you shall keep the every commandment which I command you today, that you may be strong and go in to possess the land which you cross over and possess, and that you may prolong your days in the land which you, Lord, swore to give to your fathers, to them and their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. For the land in which you go to possess is not like the land of Egypt, from which you have come, where you sowed your seed, watered it by foot, as a vegetable garden. But the land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water from the rain of heaven, a land which the Lord your God cares. The eyes of the Lord your God are always on it, from the beginning of the year to the very end. And it shall be that if you diligently obey my commandments, which I command you today, to Ahav, to love the Lord your God, and serve him with all your heart, with all your soul, then I will give you the rain for your land in its season, the earthly early rain and the latter rain, that you may gather in your grain and your new wine and your oil. The whole concept of being blessed as a result of obedience. The whole concept, if you'll turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 10, please. The whole concept of obedience to God's way, because his way is a way of blessing. The essence of the law, verse 12 of chapter 10. What is the heart and the intent? What is the scent of his law? Now, O Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? To fear. You mean God isn't a loving God? Sure he is. Sure he is. But why should we fear him? Because if you disobey him, you'll pay a price. Fear him. Fear the Lord your God. Walk in his ways. And love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. And keep the commandments of Yahweh, the Lord, and his statutes which I command you today for your good. So God is a loving God, Ahab, who gives us commandments which are his standards, his principles of love towards man. And man, when he obeys those standards and principles and Ahab, loves them, in return is blessed. Verse 16, therefore circumcise the foreskin of your heart and be stiff-necked no longer. For the Lord your God is a God of gods, a Lord of lords, a great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and takes no bribe. He administers justice for the fatherless, the widow, and the stranger, and loves the stranger, and giving him food and clothing. Therefore, love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You see, when we look at the way God expresses love towards us in his principles, and our love is expressed in obedience to God, and the ability then to influence our own lives, our mates' lives, our neighbours' lives, they're going to know you're different. They're going to know you're different. So the first reason is that he is the creator. He is the one that makes the standards. The second reason is he has liberated us from slavery. Therefore, we ought to love the freedom we have under the auspices of God's way of life. And thirdly, let's turn to Exodus 34. Exodus chapter 34. Now, this was about the time, Genesis. This was about the time of the second bunch of tablets taken up, because Moses had got angry and cast them down to the ground. And now he had gone down, and he was down the mountain, and he had to take the tablets back up to Yahweh, Jehovah, YHVH, the Lord. And he was told in chapter 34, verse 1, you go cut 2 tablets out and bring them up to me in the morning. And Moses said to him, look, will you show me your glory? He says that in chapter 33 and verse 17. Show me your glory. And basically the answer is, you can't see me, verse 20, and live. So I won't show you my glory. So what does he do? We come to the place, let's read the entrance to verse 4. So he cut the 2 tablets of stone and went up the mountain. And verse 5, then Yahweh descended in a cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name Yahweh. And then it says, Yahweh passed before him and proclaimed. And this is what he said about himself. This is his character. This is who he is. I'll just read it straight through. Yahweh, Yahweh, Elohim, merciful, gracious, long-suffering, abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and children's children to the third and fourth generations. So Moses made haste, bowed his head down towards the earth and worshipped him. I made this comment last time I spoke in Denver, not exactly the same subject, but I said, you know, people struggle over how to say the Tetragrammaton, the 4YHVH. Bottom line is nobody knows. The vowel pointers have been lost. And does it really matter? And the answer is no. What does matter is, what is the character of this divine being? What is he? You know, I made a list here of the 9 points that I just read very quickly. He's merciful. And let's ask ourselves the question, are we merciful? Are we forgiving? He's kind. Are we kind? I can think of many times I have not been kind with this thing we call a tongue. Like, I read a quote which I memorized. It says, if given the opportunity to be kind or right, choose kind. If given the opportunity to be kind or right, choose kind. Oftentimes we can argue a point to be right and we ram home the point. And we're not being very kind. Choose kind. It's part of godly character. Gracious. You know, graciousness is it's a wonderful quality. You defer, you're polite, you're kind in the words you say, you don't use foul language, you don't tick off people by calling them a silly fat jerk or whatever. You just don't do these things. You're gracious. You're entertaining, you're willing to entertain. Long-suffering, patient, putting up with stuff, you know. Long-suffering. We're going through a period of long-suffering with my wife right now. And it's 5 weeks, and it'll be another 4 or 5 weeks as well before she can get out, probably, because she's got to put her foot up and ice it down, and she can't bear the weight on it for a long period of time. She can't sit in the car for a long time because of the possibility of clots, and on and on and on it goes. And honey, will you get this, and will you get that, and do this and do that, and I do the dishes and I do the cooking, and she hollers from the front room into the kitchen, and we have to put up with all of these things and not get impatient and not get frustrated and not get short and be long suffering, abounding in goodness, always doing good, always doing what is right. That's what God does for us. Abounding in truth.
Can be difficult sometimes, can't it? Telling the truth. That can be difficult sometimes. Because you don't want to be blatant about it. Can we soften the words? and still remain true. Keeping mercy. That's the second time that mercy is mentioned in this list. Keeping mercy. Not only is he merciful, but he keeps it. Protects it, guards it, if you will. The eighth quality, forgiving iniquity. Iniquity means immoral and gross behavior. Forgiving the bad things that we do as human beings. And number nine, forgiving transgression. In other words, when we break the law, when we break the rule, when we break the code of conduct, and we see it, we forgive. Forgiving is a very, very hard thing to do. Very, very hard thing to do. To genuinely let go. To genuinely say, okay, I do not hold anything against you. Even when you're not getting an apology. Even when the person refuses to acknowledge they're wrong. You can let it go. It's a wonderful thing when you do. And he forgives, let go our transgressions. Now, out of the list of things, there are two other things that he does not do. He does not clear guilty people. He holds them accountable. You don't get away with it with God. He holds them accountable. And that's number 10. And number 11, visiting or bringing the iniquity of the third and fourth generation. The penalties are passed down from generation to generation for bad behavior and disobedience. And you know, I'm very thankful that I have not followed in my father's footsteps. Now, my father came back from World War II after fighting in the jungles of Burma, and I can't remember him being sick, unwell physically. I remember him as being an unmotivated individual, and it frustrated my mother to no end. He smoked all the time, and eventually he turned to drink, and eventually he died from cirrhosis of the liver. Drank himself to death. And we had to separate as a family. We couldn't live with him. He set the house on fire once by smoking in bed. And so we had to separate. And I could equally have gone down that road. My brother could have. My sister could have. But we have made a dedicated decision in our lives. I mean, I enjoy a drink like anyone else. But I have my limits. I have my boundaries. And I know what they are, and I keep them. Because I don't want to have the father's example passed down to me, to my children, to my grandchildren. We pass down good behavior. My grandchildren have never seen me angry. My grandchildren have never seen me drunk. My grandchildren have never seen me speeding. In fact, they say, come on, Granddad, I know it says 20 miles an hour up Mesa Drive, but you can go faster, it's all right. No. Let's just be obedient to the rules of the land and drive 20 miles an hour up there, and then we're okay. You know, it's just a simple example. Now Sydney's driving. Granddad sits back and smiles. Okay, parents, get on with it. Passing down to generation is so important. And God's way passed down, his way of love passed down from generation to generation pays off. The overview here is that God is wonderfully generous and overwhelmingly kind to us human beings. That being the case, as this is the way he is with us, he loves us by having all of those characteristics which are in the verb form. It's what he does. It's what he does. He also tells us to ahav our neighbor, to love our neighbor. Now, I won't take time to do this. Leviticus 19, from 9 through 18, is a list of things that you can read. It starts out with gleaning. We're not farmers, but if we were, we could leave crops in the field or allow people to glean. That's charitable deeds. And then it talks about not cursing the blind, not putting a stumbling block, cursing the deaf, not putting a stumbling block, being just in judgment. It talks about, let me think of the other things now, not standing idly by the life of your neighbour, not gossiping, having just judgment. You know, one of the things we've lacked in the Church of God is the implementation of Matthew 18, where you're to bring two witnesses, which is an Old Testament principle. And we should be doing that in the church, and we haven't done it in the past, and I'm the recipient of two incidents like that. But I'm still attending church, and I'm still faithful to my way, and I'm not going to let something that certain people do put me off living in God's way. But I do know this, that we must be just. And in my life, I will be just. I will be just. And so that's one of the things about loving your neighbour. Don't misjudge them. Don't draw conclusions which are not right. Follow God's way. And gossiping. Why do we gossip? Why do we tell tales outside of about somebody else and talk about something? If you can't talk to the person and tell them about it exactly, if someone upsets you, don't go to the minister. Go to the person. I heard not too long ago someone said, so I did this, and they went to the minister, and then the minister came to say me. I said, time out. You go to the minister and tell him this is not the way to do it. Go to Matthew 18. Go through that with the minister. Talk to him politely. Then go to that person, the pair of you, and sort it out. That's the way we do things in God's church. That is the law of love as far as loving our neighbour is concerned. You don't slander, and so forth. What in this section of Scripture can we not do today? We can do everything in the Scripture. We can do everything in this commandment. So how come the commandments kind of are not important anymore? Only the Ten Commandments and only the Sabbath? Well, no, we don't want that because it's changed to Sunday. How do we reach these conclusions when you read the original scriptures that Messiah opened the minds of the disciples to? How can you come to these conclusions? Well, we know why. They're deceived. Okay, it's a rhetorical statement as such. If we are lying or have deceit or division or slander or theft or adultery or divorce, we're not behaving in the actions of Ahab to love by deed. It's a verb. Let's look at Mark's account over to Mark chapter 12. See, when we ignore the Old Testament, which we do not in the Church of God, and I'm thankful we don't, but when we ignore the Old Testament and the principles behind it, we and just read the New Testament, and I can think of times when I've read over this and just left it, that's interesting. Mark 12:28. And one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, perceiving that he had asked them well, asked him, which is the first commandment of all? Or the foremost commandment, the margin gives the alternate translation. And it goes to the Shema, Deuteronomy chapter 6. And Jesus answered him and said, the first of all the commandments is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the first commandment. But he didn't stop there, did he? Because if you don't love God's commandments, or if you do love God's commandments, you will love your neighbour. But they weren't loving God's commandments, and so Jesus said, the second is like unto it, that you shall love your neighbour as yourself. And there is no other commandment greater than these. So the scribe said to him, well said, teacher, you have spoken the truth, for there is one God, and there is no other but he, and to love him with all of our heart and with all of our understanding and with all of our soul and with all of our strength, and to love one's neighbour as oneself is more than the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. So when Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." And after that, no one dared question him. And let's take this back into the time frame. When did Mark see this? When Jesus was alive. When was the book of Mark written? Approximately in the mid-60s AD. So we have a gap of some 30 years, approximately, between the event and being written down. So what was Mark referring to, or what was Jesus referring to, was only the scriptures. That's the only logical piece of work he could have been referring to, right? So clearly what he means here is what we have read, and I've referred to Leviticus 19, which we didn't read, but I encourage you to do it and just see the series of things that it says, and Deuteronomy 6, the Shema. The gentleman who is a scribe would have known the context of this. He would have understood what Jesus was saying when he referred to those two scriptures and the context of those two scriptures. He would have known and understood it. Today we don't even look at it, not the Church of God, but I mean, people today don't even look at it. Oh, just love God and love man and leave it there, and they don't go back to the context. And that's the problem with not going back to the original scriptures that Jesus was referring to at this time. So, in obeying those two commandments, which, number one, give us the conditions of what love is from our loving Father to us as human beings, and secondly, that gives us a way of life which we learn to live and reflect and to love God towards our wife, our children, our associates at work, our neighbours, and so forth, is the way of life reflecting God himself. And remember in John chapter 8, if you'll turn over there, and we were reading the booklet, The Real Jesus, if you recall that, and it's been amazing to me as I've gone through that entire booklet two or three times, and that's part of my luxuriation in reading it. It's a very, very good book in many respects. But John 8, 58. Jesus said unto them, "Most assuredly I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." The title of a deity. Now we have to go back to Genesis chapter 2 and about verse 4 to realize that YHVH, Yahweh, Jehovah, is the first time that the name is mentioned. Before that it's always God, Elohim. But clearly, Jesus is claiming here to be the deity, and that's why they got so mad and wanted to pick up stones to stone him. He was committing blasphemy in their eyes. Well, would Jesus contradict his own laws that he stated as the Creator God? Well, that doesn't make sense, does it? Could we twist and distort the word fulfill to do away when he's saying, "I'm not come here to teach badly to loose," Matthew 5:17, "but I have come to do them completely or fully or wholly." And yet we can take one word in our religious world and take it out of context and say, this does away with the law. It just really doesn't make sense. But then God hasn't called them, and then they're not responsible. I want to just spend a few moments on the second word. Hesed. H-E-S-E-D. Hesed is the second word. Hesed is one of the richest and most theologically insightful terms in the Old Testament. It denotes kindness, love, loyalty, and mercy. I'm not sure if it's associated with Hasidic Jews. It may or may not be, but that would make sense to me. I tried to look that up and I couldn't get much sense out of it. But Hesed is kindness, loyalty, love, and mercy. It describes a relationship that God has for us and his covenant people. And it's so specific it's very difficult to translate. For example, it's translated as steadfast love in the English Standard Version and the Revised Standard Version, loyal love or covenant faithfulness in the New English Translation, unfailing love in the New Living Translation, and loving kindness in the King James and New King James. Loving kindness. Hesed is used three times in God's relationship with us, and it's also used in human behavior towards each other. Let's have a look at Micah. Micah. Micah chapter 6 and verse 8. He has shown you, O man, what is good. Remember this one? Micah 6, 8. And what does Yahweh require of you? But to do justly, to love hesed. It says mercy here, but the Hebrew is hesed, which is, in the margin of my New King James Version, loving kindness. So let's reread it. To do justly, to have loving kindness towards one another, towards wives and brothers and sisters and workmates, and to walk humbly with your God. Psalm 89, verse 14. Psalm 89, verse 14. Psalm 89, verse 14. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Mercy, hesed, loving kindness, and truth go before your face, wrote the psalmist. So hesed defines God's rule. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne, and steadfast love and faithfulness go before you. Defining the characteristics of God's love and forgiveness can be seen in Isaiah 54. So let's have a look at Isaiah 54. Isaiah 54 and verse 5. For your Maker is your husband, the Lord of hosts is his name, and your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. He is called God, or the Mighty One of the whole earth. For the Lord God has called you. Like a woman forsaken and grieved in spirit, like a youthful wife when you were refused, says your God, for a mere moment I have forsaken you, but with great mercies I will gather you. With a little wrath I hide my face from you for a moment, but with everlasting kindness, has said, I will have mercy on you, says the Lord, your Redeemer. It's a beautiful word. Hesed is absolutely gorgeous when you see it in this context. And he goes on to say, for this is like the waters of Noah to me, for I have sworn that the waters of Noah would no longer cover the earth, so I have sworn, that I would not be angry with you nor rebuke you, for the mountain shall depart and the hill shall be moved, but my kindness shall not depart from you, nor shall my covenant of peace be removed, says the Lord, who has hesed, loving kindness, on you. You know, I began my comments talking about bravery of the men who died on D-Day. I also said that the world's going crazy, and in many ways it is. Today's normal is not our normal, I hope, in that sense. Today's normal, I hope, is God's normal, because certainly this is not normal in our society today, when we have the incredibly wild thinking of, well, if a boy feels like a boy, he should be able to use the girl's bathroom. Please, don't you know that the federal government passed down a law that in certain states, or the states, and if a state has a law which says boys and girls have separate bathrooms and that's it, they will withhold funding if they do not tolerate what they call bisexual or transsexual behaviour. Please, we're becoming Sodom and Gomorrah. Nothing is held back. This is the leadership of our country. It's not normal. Our Father and His Son has made it clear what love is. It's not abstract. It's not an interpretation of a proposition, which is what happens in Greek, to be quite frank with you. Look up what the word proposition means. It's a very interesting study. It is concrete. It's a verb. It's what you do. What you do. Not what you feel. You do the standards of God, but you do it with the right heart and a right motivation. It's not wafty and nebulous. It's based on laws of obedience. These eternal principles, when broken, bring about a consequence, and sin never pays off. We have a loving Father who calls us personally. I believe my life would have been very, very different had I not been called. I was in ignorance. I was brought up in poverty. Normal society was a very harsh one. And when I think about my grandparents went through World War I, my grandfather on my mother's side died from mustard gassing out of World War I. And man married again and had one other son. And Arthur Cook died from pneumonia silicosis or black lung from coal mining. She lived a hard life. She lived a hard life. My grandparents on my father's side, World War I, the Great Depression, World War II. Very unhappy people. I have no memories of love, of kindness from them at all. They didn't have it to give. They didn't have it to give. So I'm looking forward to a time when I can talk to them again. They're not broken, not beaten down. My grandparents in London had huge bunions on each big toe, and they had to cut the slit across so that the leather spread out and the bunion wouldn't hurt as they walked. My grandfather's knuckles were all arthritic. Just hard, hard days, hard times. Very, very sad. Well, we have a loving Father who calls us personally and has given me an incredible, wonderful understanding and knowledge as a result of a way of life. Tomorrow is Shavuot or Pentecost. God has given us something. He's given us something. He's opened our mind. We have mixed an ingredient of our human spirit with His spirit. And He wants us to use that spirit, if you will, with our own will and our own mind and our own understanding to learn, to see, to comprehend what His love is. His standards, His values, as we've talked about before. And our love is based in loving obedience. The principles which make for a good life now and a good life as a spirit being. We learn through practice, and our example is our Father and His Son. Those are our examples, and the greatest example we have, of course, is Jesus Christ laying down His life for us. So, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, and with all your soul. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself.